Dave Dawson trained as a lawyer, but never had much love for the legal profession, and always harboured a desire to one day start his own design company. That day arrived in 2003, when he decided to quit his day job and launch the Urban Electric Company, a lighting brand based in Charleston, South Carolina. Over the past 15 years, the brand has gradually built a name for itself for its robust yet elegant made-in-America lighting fixtures. The company now employs over 200 people across its factory in Charleston and its headquarters. You're listening to The Entrepreneurs with me, Matt Alagaya. Today, Dave Dawson is here to explain how he built the Urban Electric Company without any stores or even an e-commerce presence, and to talk us through his plans for the next decade.
I enjoyed law, did it for several years, but pretty early on realized that was not my lifelong ambition. When I looked at what partners in the law firm were doing and I pictured myself 30 years from then, I thought, no, I don't see that. Always had a little bit of a bent to try to do, I guess, entrepreneurial things, whether it was, you know, selling t-shirts in college or flipping houses or, you know, that type of thing. So I always knew I wanted to do something of my own. Just didn't quite know what it was, had no expectation that it would be in the design industry, let alone the manufacturing industry, had no background in either one of those.
Interesting. I mean, you had no background in it. What made you move into that industry?
Sheer ignorance. A little bit of naivete, I think. I mean, long story short, I had met my wife in San Francisco on a second life, which was a little brief stint in high tech. We sold the company that we had, moved to Charleston, South Carolina, which is a beautiful old historic town, mostly because of lifestyle reasons. It seemed like a really cool place to live. Had no idea what we were going to do for a living, and we were restoring an old Charleston single, which is Charleston's contribution to the architecture world is something called a Charleston single, they've got lots of these old homes, and we were restoring one of those from the 1860s. And that was the first time that I had really become exposed to what is available in the shelter supply industry. And at that time, there was not much that I thought was really meaningful or unique in the lighting industry. And so that gave us this thought that, hey, maybe Charleston would be a neat place to start a lighting showroom, which is how Urban Electric started first. Was the concept was a retail showroom. We did that for about a year, year and a half, and quickly morphed into the manufacturing side when we realized that the retail business was a little limiting. We wanted to create something unique. We wanted to create a niche that was very, very special that nobody else was doing. We thought that was our path from a business standpoint. But when you're doing retail, you're obviously selling other people's designs. You're exposed to whoever else they're selling to, et cetera. We made the decision that we wanted to start to design our own stuff. That's when we got synced up with our creative director, Michael Amato. And so he and I have now been working together over 15 years. And he was actually a customer of our retail store. And I started telling him that I wanted to start to do something that was a little bit unique. He said he would help us. He actually had a true design background, unlike me. And then we tried to figure out how to get somebody to make our designs. And at that time, that was in the early 2000s. It's changed a little bit now, but in that time in the United States, manufacturing was kind of on the ropes. I think the general zeitgeist at the time was that America was going to become a country of consumers and we could let other people manufacture things.
So everyone was kind of offshoring to, Asia, the Far East.
Exactly. I mean, where I'm from in the Carolinas, there was a long history of textile mills, furniture making in western North Carolina. All of that stuff was going away very rapidly. So when we set out to try to find somebody to make our designs, we found it was nearly impossible in the United States. And so that led to the second piece to this idea was we said, well, if we're really going to do this thing and we want to make something really, truly unique to us, let's not just design it. Let's make it ourselves. And I remember thinking at the time, how hard can that be, really? And that was where the naivete came in, because I had no clue how hard it really is to manufacture. Thankfully, we didn't know. And so we said, okay, let's give it a shot. We actually ended up acquiring a very small lantern maker, an older man in Charleston who's 80 years old, who'd been doing lanterns forever. He offered to sell me his business, which was him and a couple of craftsmen. I just said, this is what we really want to do. And so whatever that's been 16 years later, not doing law, but I can't really imagine practicing law. I can't imagine loving anything more than what I'm doing now, but certainly came about it in a roundabout way.
Let's look at the design side now. I mean, you said that you didn't have any background in design. I don't think your wife did either, but Did you always feel like you had a good eye for a good design, a good piece of lighting, a good piece of furniture?
A little bit. I would say that's true. I mean, I always joke that I had no design background, but I was always the lawyer who kept all of his architectural digests, you know? I mean, I was always at a very, very hobby level interested in design. I think, you know, it does help. I always say I'm not the talent in our business. Our craftsmen are the talent. Our designers like Michael are the talent. But it does help to be able to kind of know good from bad sometimes, for sure.
Yeah. And do you feel like Urban Electric Company has a unique kind of aesthetic? I mean, is it something that you've been able to build up over the past 16 years? Or is it more utilitarian? Is it more functional for each sort of project that you go into?
Both, but I would say primarily it is we do have an aesthetic that we're fairly well known for, which is classically grounded, contemporary feeling stuff. So we will take very, very clean lines. We don't do a lot of ornate design. We like to let the proportion or the scale speak for itself, the lines of a particular light. We don't do a lot of extra jeweling of the light fixture. But then we'll give it maybe a modern twist, a pop of neon color or something that makes it feel fresh, but always very classically grounded.
On the manufacturing side, you mentioned that if you'd known how difficult it was, you might not have attempted it. Just talk us through how you managed to make it happen. Because I think, as you sort of pointed out, a lot of people now are reshoring manufacturing. It's become quite trendy to, start making stuff in the West again, I guess. But when you started, it really was going against the grain. How did you make it work?
We've seen, and it's been really rewarding and satisfying for us to see this movement again back toward, I think people recognize now, and I'm sure it's the same in the UK as it is in the United States, there's something really necessary at a soul level in making things. I think it's an important part of humanity. So we're very gratified to see that, and we kind of think, we were a little bit early to that and maybe helped some of that. But in the early days for us, again, we had no background in it, so this was a bit of blind leading the blind. It was really honestly a series of experimentation, failure, learning, and, move on. That old saying, the journey of 1,000 miles begins with the first step. I mean, when we said we want to make everything ourselves, had no idea what that journey looked like, but we sort of knew what we wanted to look like at the end of it. And so we just we'd try one thing, see if it worked or not. That led us to the next step, to the next step. And then, you wake up 16 years later and you've been doing it for a while. But very, very early on, there was a lot of trial and error, and still is.
Do you ever come up against the limitations of making something in the US? I mean, are there materials that are simply too expensive, or are there techniques that you find are too expensive to do in the US in an expensive market?
Sometimes. That's true. And for us, we have to know where we play. We have to know what our strengths are, what our weaknesses are, try to stay away from the weaknesses. Much like manufacturing in Britain, I'm sure, we are at a cost disadvantage coming into any conversation. We're at a cost disadvantage to foreign competitors. There's no doubt. I mean, that's the reality of where we are. And that's because of a lot of good things. We pay our craftsmen wages that they raise families on. We give them, they've got paid vacations. They've got health insurance. We run our factory per federal safety guidelines and, handle our waste properly. All those sorts of things come with cost. They're all the right thing to do, but they definitely come with the cost. So for us, what we've had to do, it's not necessarily particular techniques or materials, although that sometimes in the particular might happen, but a lot of it has to do with how we approach our processes as much as anything. And that's something that we've really had to hone in on and say, for all the disadvantages that I just listed, I think we've got tremendous advantages as well. For one thing, all of our engineers, designers, craftsmen, artisans, everybody is in the same room. I think that's a huge advantage in terms of quick cycles of innovation. We're very close to our customer. We understand what they want. We have a passionate workforce. All of those things are huge advantages. The challenge for us, I guess, is to say, how do we limit the disadvantages and exploit those advantages? For us, it has to do with how we spend our time. And by that, I mean, we spend as much of our time as we can focused on things that add value for our client and try not to do the things that don't add value for our client. And the way that we define value in this case, quite simply, things that our clients are willing to pay us more for. If they're willing to pay us more for higher quality, let's do more of that. If they're willing to pay us for shorter lead times, let's figure out that. If they're willing to pay us for more customization, let's do that. Are they willing to pay us to waste time, you know, finding a tool or a print set that got lost? Absolutely not. And so for us, we say, let's try to figure out how to orient our day so that we are spending more of our day. And we're not perfect at this. We're not Toyota Motor or something. But, you know, we're saying, let's figure out how we spend as much of our day adding value for our clients in our processes and as little time on waste, what, you know, basically things that don't add value. And that's how we stay competitive. So it's a long answer to your question. I don't think it's necessarily a particular technique or material. Sometimes we work with outside partners for certain things. Most of it, much of it, we do in-house. But it's more around how we're able to really bring value to the process.
And when we look at the workforce, you mentioned a couple of times there that you have a passionate workforce. You've written a lot about company culture in the past. I mean, it seems like, you know, you have apprenticeships and you're supporting your workforce in that way. Just talk us through a little bit about how you've, I guess you've grown the company culture of Urban Electric Company.
Well, it's, you know, that's something obviously I am really passionate about. I'm passionate about the sustainability of craftsmanship, passionate about how we make sure that this type of activity is relevant. And to me, I think relevance primarily has to do with, in this context at least, has to do with economic relevance. I mean, you know, unless you've got a Medici patron or something, you really have to make sure that what you're doing as an artisan or a craftsman has market relevance. And what we realized very early on when we started the business was that there was a huge gap in the skills of the people that we were interviewing to what we needed. I think probably in Europe, there's a much longer history of apprenticeship and journeymen and those sorts of programs, more formalized or informal. In the United States, we really don't have that. And when we started, again, in early 2000s, we had kind of lost a whole generation of kids who had taken shop class in high school or kids whose parents aspired for them to be makers in some way. That put us at a deficit. A couple years in, created our own apprentice program, mostly out of necessity because we said we really need some way to pass, make sure that these trades and this knowledge gets passed on to new people because we obviously need new blood coming into the business as we grow, and they weren't coming with those skills. We created an apprentice program, which in the very, very early days was quite simple. It was just a, you know, here's your mentor. You guys hang out for the next year and learn. But I think it gave new apprentices a real sense of confidence, gave us a program, a structure that we could pass this knowledge on. It also gave the craftsman a career path. Much like anybody else would have a career path and say, if I work hard, we said to them, look, if you work hard, you stick at this, you learn what the knowledge that you need to know over time, here's a career path. And you can go from an apprentice to a craftsman to a senior craftsman to a master craftsman. And that's a pretty big deal. And that, I think, has also allowed us to have a pretty sticky workforce. We've got people who've been with us for 6, 8, 10, 12 years and gave them a sense of satisfaction and path in their career while also building up these skills. Now, as the program has developed now over the years, now we have a full-time person who does curriculum planning. We spend a ton of time in training and development on our team because it's kind of, it's the lifeblood of what we're trying to do and will be, that's the piece that will carry us into the future as well.
Let's look now about how you built the company, because we go back 16 years and you set up this company. And I think I'm right in saying that you didn't have a showroom, you didn't have a shop, you didn't have e-commerce because e-commerce wasn't massive then. How did you build up the brand without all of those kind of those things that you normally feel like you need?
Right. Well, it was a bit counterintuitive, maybe. You know, we're in a small town. Charleston is a really unique, interesting city, but it's a very small city. It's out of the way. The big markets that we need to reach are New York, Los Angeles, London, and we're not there. So in a way, we were sort of, I don't know if we were early to this, but we were kind of before digital companies, you know, were a thing. We were an early adopter of that because we just relied on the internet. I mean, we had the advantage of starting in the age of the internet. You pointed out it was the early days. E-commerce was not nearly what it is today. But still, you had a platform to be able to get your message out. And so we didn't have to necessarily rely on the traditional model where you put your stuff in a showroom, someone looked at it, and then called you. So over the years, we've built our business. It's basically everything is in Charleston. All of our manufacturing, all of our inside sales team. We have a few outside sales folks who travel around the country, and we've actually got someone here in London as well. But we would advertise in shelter magazines like Architectural Digest, El Decor, those World of Interiors. That generated interest for people to come to our website. Our website was our showroom, and then they'd pick up the phone and talk to somebody who was in Charleston. And for us, we had a lot of people over the years ask us if they could represent us in their showrooms. I think in some ways that we always said no. We felt very strongly that we wanted to be able to control that communication channel. We didn't want anybody between us and the interior designer. But in some ways, that probably slowed our growth a little bit. It might have been an easier path to leverage the contacts and the showrooms that these people had. But we really felt like if we stood for something that we wanted to come through, then nobody did that better than our people. So when a client is talking to our inside sales team, they're literally talking to somebody who's sitting 50 feet from the craftsmen who are building the product. And that again, those short communication lines, I think, have allowed us to get our message, position ourselves the way we want to make sure that our client has the best possible experience, and there's nobody that's getting in between that. So it was, as you point out, it was probably a little bit of a counterintuitive strategy and maybe a harder climb, but it's worked out for us in the end, and we're very happy with where it is now.
It's an important distinction, I guess, to make, that you weren't so much B2C. It was more B2B. It was interior designers were your customers. You know, there were people fitting out restaurants and hotels. In those early days, was there one project you think that really grabbed attention? I mean, was there one hotel or one restaurant where suddenly everyone was asking about your lighting because it was just such a good project?
I wish I could give you something. I can't think of anything off the top. I do remember there used to be a magazine in the United States called Southern Accents, and they used to do these show houses. I remember doing a show house with Southern Accents very early on, like 2 or 3 years in, and the lighting that we did in that really got a lot of people's attention. We got a lot of calls for that. I can't remember any really one project that maybe put us on the map.
And in terms of, I mean, you said that your website was your showroom. How important was word of mouth also in those early days? I mean, were there people who, you know, a big interior designer started recommending you to others and friends? Did you feel that there was a bit of word of mouth trickle down as well?
Absolutely. You know, and that's where a huge part of what we do as well is related to the client service. There are a lot of people who make things out of metal. That's not necessarily unusual. I do think our designs are really beautiful and sophisticated. I think our craftsmanship is amazing. But I think at the end of the day, our product is not inexpensive. People have a high, high expectation for how you're going to support that product. Early on, made the decision we wanted to put a lifetime warranty on our products before we knew what we were doing. I remember doing that, and our attorney said, "Are you sure you want to do this?" Because he says, "You really don't know what you're getting into." And I said, "No, I think we have to, because kind of what you said, we had to give people the confidence so that they could spread that word by word of mouth and say, these guys must be confident if they're putting a lifetime warranty on it," which we've always now have had and become, I think, that's an important part of our offering. We have our own in-house white glove services that take care of clients. That's the type of, you know, we have warehouses. We have regional warehouses in Los Angeles and New York and Miami. We're getting ready to open something in Chicago. These are craftsmen who are permanently located in these areas to give clients a really great on-site experience so that we don't just ship product from the factory. It shows up and then they're on their own. Those types of experiences, I think, are really key to spreading the word. You know, it doesn't take, you know, I've flown a craftsman across the country before to take care of a piece of glass for a client. We probably lost money on that job. But in the big picture, we win, because I can guarantee you that client told 20 people about that story. I can't believe Urban Electric did that. And so I think that's a really important piece to it. So your question is absolutely dead on.
When it comes to where the company is today, I mean, give us a sense of how it's grown over the past 16 years. I mean, for starters, scale-wise, you're over 200 people now.
Well, so when we first started in the retail store, it was me and Jen and a part-time person. And then when we first got into the lantern business, we had a couple more people, and we were in a workshop that was probably 1,000 square feet. Now we're in 120,000 square feet. We've got 235 employees. So the scale has gotten bigger. The interesting thing is, and when I talk to people about this a lot, the interesting thing for me as I reflect back on that is when we first started and we were in the 1,000 square feet and there were four or five of us, we said the purpose of the, or what we really want to do with this company is make high quality customized luxury lighting for the interior design business. And, you know, the room's gotten bigger and the team's gotten bigger. But when we sit here and say, what are we trying to do? What are we doing now? What are we looking at over the next 5-10 years? High quality, customized luxury lighting for the interior design business. And what we want to do hasn't really changed. Our focus is just trying to get better at what we do. We don't really have a grand strategy to change what we do in any way, but we do think that incremental improvements in how we do it, that is the strategy for us.
And have you grown it relatively organically, or have you gone outside for investment? Have you, what have you done on the financial side?
We've been pretty fortunate to do it ourselves. It's probably been 8 or 10 years ago. We had a small recapitalization with friends and family, but we've never gone out to go get outside private equity money or something like that. I like that. You know, we've obviously relied on, you know, there's a choice when you're doing that, especially in a pretty capital intensive business like we are, you know, equipment, plant, there's a lot of things that have to be invested in, inventory, flooring, et cetera. We've made the choice, or I've made the choice, that I would much rather do that with debt if we have to, small amounts, never over levered, but small amounts of debt rather than giving up equity. To me, at the end of the day, equity is why I'm doing this, or that's one of the things that I love about this, is that we can call this our own. And we have this conversation a lot internally, but I think I would prefer a smaller, slower than I would to get outside capital.
And now, looking to the future, or rather the very near future, 2018 is set up to be quite an important year. So you're opening in London very soon, an office here, and you're also launching e-commerce. Talk us through some of those big changes and what the thinking behind them.
Well, the London office is fun. That's our creative director now lives over here full time. That was really a decision because you know, London is an important market. We see it as a growing market for us. It's a place where we think that we speak to the aesthetic of London. London's also a very important gateway. London is a huge market in itself. We always say London is by itself is New York. New York is our number one market. London equals that, obviously, in terms of opportunity. But London has the plus side that it's a bit of a gateway to the rest of Europe, Russia, the Middle East, you know, etc. So for us, London's a really big market. So we are starting to lay the groundwork for how we can more meaningfully move into this market instead of trying to do it from afar. Like I said, our creative director has relocated over here, and so our creative hub or creative studio will be here. We've hired a full-time business development person to work in the London area. I think those will be meaningful things, and over the course of the next several years, we will probably expand that footprint. The e-commerce side is, you know, we were just talking about how we grew this in an unorthodox way without that, without showrooms and e-commerce. Now I think we're ready for that. I've always been a little bit hesitant about it because our product is a bit, I would say, complex for a typical e-commerce situation. It's not a click and buy. There's a lot of configuration. We offer hundreds of different finishes and configurations and sizes, and even on any one given SKU. So we've always been a little bit hesitant to think that our product is amenable to that. But we've now made the determination that we can do that, that we can offer online configuration, online purchasing in a really meaningful way. And that, again, is when we look at what we're trying to do from a strategic standpoint, we're doing this old line thing. People have been making decorative objects out of metal for 1,000 years. That's not particularly innovative. We think the way that we look at ourselves as an innovation company, even though we're not creating the next internet wave or curing cancer or something. We think that we are an innovation company in the small and incremental ways that we change this business that we're in. Meaning, how do we sustain artisanal craft, handmade craft? How do we offer a completely made-to-order product, but do it in a way that is relevant to the modern world? And so much of that for us has to do with reducing the barriers between this beautiful object that's made in Charleston and our clients. We always talk about reducing the friction that our clients have, because people generally say, oh, that's amazing. It's beautiful work. It's made by hand by a craftsman. That's really attractive. So what are the barriers then? Why would someone not buy that? Is it lead time? Is it a price point? Is it the way that we offer it for sale? And that leads to this point about e-commerce. Because of the way that the world works these days, even products like ours, I think, you know, we don't think that all of our clients will want to do business with us online, but a significant portion of them will. And if it's 20 or 25% who can self-serve, configure their product online, we break down one more barrier between our clients and what we're doing in Charleston. And for us, that's a win.
And is this a slight pivot away from the B2B side and towards a customer who might just want two or three lamps for their house? Or are you sticking with the old business model, which is a bit more B2B?
Well, I think it's both. I think it will certainly make our product available a little more broadly. I think clients now, or let's say homeowners now, or consumers might get on our website now and not. We do sell to consumers now, so it's not a departure from what we do. But if you were to go on our website right now, you would probably feel like we're not necessarily set up to do business with you. And we want to remove that obstacle. But even still, the vast majority of our business, we think, will always be with the design trades. They are the ones who understand our product. They are the ones who have to help place our product, educate the homeowner or the restaurant owner or whoever on the value of our product and help navigate them through that process. So the website is a meaningful move toward removing some obstacles for the consumer, but more it's a tool for our trade still.
And when we look at the move to London, is that part of a broader global expansion, do you think? I mean, over the next 5 years, are you looking to enter Europe in a bigger way? Is it the Middle East or Russia, two markets that you mentioned?
Well, no, not beyond London. I mean, I think at this point that London would be about as much as we could bite off, and that's a big move for us. But we are considering physical showrooms in a couple of other cities as well, New York and Los Angeles. Again, trying to just be present in the places that we need to be. But I would say for the foreseeable future, when you say 5 years, it would be London would probably be as far afield as we do business all over the world now. I mean, last year we shipped to over 30 countries. So we're able to do business, but in terms of having a physical presence or making more of an outbound approach, probably London will be the extent of our ambition over the next several years.
I'm afraid that's all we have time for on today's show. Thank you very much to Dave Dawson for sharing the story of Urban Electric Company. This show was produced by Daniel Bache and mixed and edited by Kieran Matthew Banerjee. I'm Matt Alagaya. Thanks very much for listening. Goodbye.